Good morning. The board has returned from break. It's 10:27. We will do a short roll call or a swift roll call to ensure that everybody has returned. Dr. Bustillo.
Here.
Dr. King.
Here.
Mr. Leone.
Here.
Mr. Greer.
Here.
Mr. Barton?
Here.
And Dr. Hike?
Here.
Ms. Crowley?
Here.
Ms. Bryant? Ms. Bryant is still absent. Ms. Richardson?
Present.
Dr. Sinish?
Here.
My name is Judy Chepius, and I also see Mr. Harris on the call as well as our Assistant Attorney General. Dr. Bustillo, the meeting is yours.
Okay, we are on to agenda item 11, old business, review, consideration, and action. And the first case is 2368, Paul Kempton, PT.
So with Mr. Kempton's case, during a continued initial hearing at its May 21st, 2024 meeting, the board voted to remand case 2368 to a formal hearing. In the interest of a prompt and judicious settlement, and subsequent to an informal settlement conference on July 1st, 2024, a consent agreement was executed on September 9th, 2024. The consent agreement included the professional monitoring and practice audit as part of its terms. Mr. Kempton has signed a contract with Copper State Professional Monitoring, which has been provided for board review. And the matter is before the board to determine whether to approve that contract and allow Mr. Kempton to move forward with his monitoring and practice audit.
Any discussion on the contract?
I do believe Mr. Kempton's attorney, Ms. Sanzio, is on the call. I did not see Mr. Kempton, but I could be wrong. I don't know if the board has any questions for them, but I just wanted to note their attendance.
So I move that we approve the contract.
Second. Any further discussion? I think we're ready, Judy.
It's been moved and seconded to approve Mr. Kempton's contract with Copper State Professional Monitoring. Dr. Bustillo?
Yes.
Dr. King?
Yes.
Mr. Leone?
Yes.
Mr. Greer?
Yes.
Mr. Barton?
Yes.
Dr. Hike?
Yes.
That motion passes.
Judy, this is Teresa Sanzio representing Mr. Kempton. For clarification purposes, if I may, I'd like to ask a question regarding the consent agreement and order paragraph number 4, the very first sentence. I just need clarification for my client. It says that respondents shall promptly comply with any recommendations that the monitor states in writing. Is respondent supposed, who's doing what in writing? What exactly needs to be in writing?
Mr. Harris, are we agendized for this?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's
Mr. Harris, you're muted.
Yeah, and Teresa, Judy, members of the board, if it's okay, perhaps we can address that question after the meeting or the next couple of days.
Thank you. That would be fine. Appreciate it.
You bet.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Our next item for consideration is case 2405, Georgia Holgren, PTA.
(Clears throat)
So at its August 27th, 2024 meeting, Ms. Holguin, PTA, despite being properly noticed, did not appear for her informal hearing in case 2405. The board voted to remand the matter to formal hearing and adopt the alleged violation of ARS 32-3208, which is a health professional who has been charged with a misdemeanor involving conduct that may affect patient safety, or a felony, after receiving or renewing a license or certificate, must notify the health professional's regulatory board in writing within 10 working days after the charge is filed. The matter is returned to the board with a request to also include an alleged violation of ARS 32-2044-7, conviction of a felony, whether or not involving moral turpitude, or a misdemeanor involving moral turpitude. As determined by the board, alleged violations will be included in the complaint and notice of hearing prepared in advance of the formal hearing for case 2405, Georgia Holguin, PTA. So the question before the board is whether or not to include an alleged violation of ARS 32-2044-7 as staff prepares the documentation for the formal hearing.
I move that we include an allegation of violation of 32-2044-7.
Thank you.
Second. Any discussion?
Thank you.
I think we're ready, Judy.
It's been moved and seconded to add an alleged violation of ARS 32-2044-7 to case 2405, Georgia Holguin, PTA. Dr. Vestia.
Yes.
Dr. King.
Yes.
Mr. Leone.
Yes.
Mr. Greer.
Yes.
Mr. Barton.
Yes.
Dr. Hike.
Yes.
That motion passes.
Okay, and then we go to item C under 11, case 2245, Robert Palmer, PTA.
Mr. Palmer is present. Mr. Palmer, can you please identify yourself?
Yes, this is Robert Palmer.
Okay. Mr. Palmer was issued a board order that had an expiration date of July 26th of 24. The latest that we received is that we were notified last night that he did pass his AZ law exam, which did satisfy one of the outstanding elements of this board order. But when I asked him several weeks ago when I contacted him why he had not completed the terms of the board order on time, he stated that he had lost track of time. He did renew his certificate, at this point, his license to practice as a PTA on August 31st of 24, and he is currently practicing full time. Of note, the CEU certificates submitted to satisfy his board order were completed on 8/31/24, the same day as he renewed his license for this renewal period. So to ensure that the CEUs required for the board order were in addition to those for his renewal requirements, I asked him to submit CEU verification for his license renewal. He did submit documentation that he had completed sufficient CEUs to satisfy both the board order and his license renewal with separate and distinct coursework. Mr. Palmer is requesting that the board retroactively approve the CEUs that were included in his file to satisfy item 2 of the board order. The board may wish to consider opening a case for failing to comply with the board order or consider other actions. This case is for your review.
Thank you. Mr. Palmer, are you willing to answer questions from the board?
Yes, ma'am.
I guess this is Karen Bustia. I think I'd really like to know how you lost track of time. This is has the potential to be a bigger deal than you want it to be.
I understand. When I began working on this, I had signed up to do the AZ law exam and was waiting on the ATT letter to come through. That was continuing to be waiting for approval. And I would like to provide you with some, you know, crazy life circumstance. I just was waiting on that. One day turned into a week, turned into a couple of months, and just find myself in a space now more, just asking for, I guess forgiveness or, you know, clemency or whatever the appropriate term would be. But I don't have a super great substantial answer to give to you.
I think that's a good question, Dr. Bustillo. Mr. Palmer, so I went back and reviewed, like, what the initial investigative report, like, how did you land here in the first place? And it was related to not following rules, practice, procedures. And so here we are again, where you didn't follow it doesn't appear then that you followed the directions within the board order of having CEUs approved and having these things completed by a specific time. And we are well past that time. It wasn't even close. And so I guess I'm just having a hard time giving any leniency to here we are again, right? You're here again, not following rules, not following the process, not following instructions. And again, asking for leniency. So just help me understand. Help us as a board understand how you're here again.
The only thing I would have to mention would be the fear of the repercussions once I realized that I had missed the original due date, and I guess kind of fear paralysis. But again,
Did you reach out to the board when you saw that you're like, I'm not going to make this? Did you let anyone know?
Not in an extremely significant way. I had drafted an email and it was stuck in my outbox, which I should have followed up to make sure it had actually sent, but not in a substantial way.
Where are you working right now full time?
I work at a skilled nursing facility in Tempe called Friendship Village for a company called Therapy Management Corporation.
Okay.
Mr. Palmer, with you having completed these courses past the deadline, can you just explain to us what did you learn from the courses?
It was a nice refresher on the fine details that I had been overlooking in terms of the supervision and ensuring that I do have the supervision and timeliness. I've followed up with my rehab director to figure out, you know, who would be my supervising therapist. The setting that I'm in currently, I have the same supervising therapist on site about 99% of the time. We have since I began here in November of 2023, there have only been very few instances where it wasn't that same supervising therapist. But in that event that he is not here, I've been sure to communicate with my rehab director on the therapist who would be supervising for that day, and being sure to annotate that in the documentation. And then again, in studying for the jurisprudence exam, just refamiliarizing myself with the statutes and such, and my responsibility that I play within maintaining those.
Thank you.
So Judy, my question to you is, after looking at all of the CEU work that he did, would the coursework that he did take, would that have satisfied his order?
Had those courses been submitted for pre-approval, it's highly likely that they would have been approved.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Palmer, I've got a follow-up question for you. Obviously, we're in a situation here due to noncompliance with the board order. Our job as a board is to ensure safe practice of physical therapy and to ensure, you know, to protect the public in this profession. A big part of the reason when we give board orders is to, one, educate our practitioners, but also to ensure that they have the ability and the consistency to, you know, follow the rules and follow the orders that we put, that are inherent in this kind of a practice. You know, the concern that I have is that I don't, you know, I, in my mind, the failure to do what we told you to do in the order raises concerns for me about you being back here with another issue later. Mm-hmm. So what, I mean, what suggestion would you have for us, or what would you have us do to make us confident that we're not going to see you again with the same issue at a skilled nursing facility that got you here in the first place?
I think being in the position that I'm in now, knowing the severity of my borderline negligence with my approach to the board order, I think is enough to strongly enhance my work ethic and make sure that I'm complying with anything that you would like me to complete in a much more timely manner, to show that I do take my job seriously on both the treatment side and the compliance side in regard to the statutes.
Mr. Palmer, are you in a PTA position, or are you in a leadership position at Friendship Village?
I'm in a PTA position.
Okay, that's right, because you're TMC. Well, I mean, I hate to state the obvious, but you were heard first in December of 2023. It could have taken a couple months to get all the paperwork to you. And you're telling us that your takeaway from the CEUs was a refresher on practice and documentation and supervision. You didn't take that till August. So you practiced under your old understanding of it for many more months after the board heard you until you took your refresher. And so that just gives us pause that we were a little more concerned about your practice than you were.
I understand.
I have no other questions. I do have some questions about what our options are. So would that be something we would need to go into executive session for? Or can Mr. Harris tell us our options?
You know, I'd be more than happy to, you know, review your options. If you want to go into executive session at any time, you're more than welcome to. But it's on the agenda for your consideration. You can take no action. You could open up a complaint for failure to timely comply with a board order, which is an act of unprofessional conduct under our statutes. If you do that, then you pretty much have your full bundle of options available to you, from, you know, dismissal to an advisory letter to a non-disciplinary order to, you know, increasing it from there. I think what you have to decide is based upon what Mr. Palmer has shared with you, whether or not this rises to, you know, opening up a complaint. It's also one of those cases, from time to time you may hear me say you can open up the case and you basically have all your facts available before you, and if you were considering a non-disciplinary action, you know, like an advisory letter, you could probably do that all today. It, you know, in the past though, there's been some reluctancy to necessarily do that. And when you've done that in the past, you've opened up a complaint, given him an opportunity to kind of re-answer why he was not, you know, he didn't comply timely. This would then be, you know, re-agendized for your initial review, where again you would have all of your options available to you. So I may have just gone all in circles, but I think the question before you right now is whether or not you want to open up a complaint or take no action.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Palmer?
Or Mr. Harris?
Or Mr. Harris.
I hope that made sense. Sorry about that.
Yeah, it did.
Mr. Harris, if we are inclined to order additional CEUs or anything like that, we would need to open a complaint, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Then, members of the board, I would move that we open a complaint in this matter.
Second.
Yeah, I feel like ignoring a board order for 6-7 months is not in Mr. Palmer's best interest. And it just really kind of snubs his nose at the board and the work that we do.
Agreed.
So it would be to open up a complaint pursuant to 32-20-44-1, I think.
Yeah, that's correct. Failure to comply with the board order.
Thank you.
Sorry, I realized that I didn't tell you what to open a complaint over.
No, that's, you're good.
Without going through the CEUs he took, Judy, do you know off the top of your head, was ethics one of them?
No.
No, it was not ordered. There, in the coursework that he submitted, over the course of this investigation into the noncompliance, there was a course for ethics. I believe, if memory serves, it was a 3-hour course. I didn't look closely at that one.
And was that one, you remember, was it taken on August 31st?
Yes.
Like all the others?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, you're correct, Judy. It was for 3 hours. Ethics, a clinical perspective for therapists. Taken on August 31st.
Okay.
Any further discussion? Okay, I think we're ready.
So just a point of clarification. So you're moving to open the complaint pursuant to 32-20-44. One, as Mr. Harris has identified, is this something that you would like to then adjudicate here today, or would it be part of this motion or a separate motion, Mr. Harris, if they decided to do that, or to bring it, have it go through the investigative phase and bring it back? Mr. Harris, you're muted.
Sorry, Judy. It's up to the board, but it sounds like we were, and the board's intent was to open up a complaint and let it go through the adjudicative process.
Okay.
And Judy, I don't know that there's additional investigation to do, but I think it needs to be agendized.
Agree.
For possible disciplinary action.
Okay.
All right, so it's been moved and seconded to open a complaint against Robert Palmer, PTA, pursuant to 32-2044-1. Dr. Bastillo?
Yes.
Dr. King?
Yes.
Mr. Leone?
Yes.
Mr. Greer?
Yes.
Mr. Barton?
Yes.
Dr. Hike?
Yes.
That motion passes.
Mr. Palmer did have his hand up in case he still has something he wants to say.
Oh, no, ma'am. It was just in regard to the ethics question, but it was addressed already. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. The board will be in touch.
Thank you, board.
Okay, then we can move on to board business and reports.
All right, so at its October 1st, 2024 meeting, the board had requested a future agenda item specific to pathways to practice in Arizona. So in pursuit of that information, the board has been provided with documentation in your records, in your drive that identified the three different pathways to practice in Arizona, in addition to some items about those specific practices. So without reading that entire thing for you, the summary is that there are three main pathways to practice in Arizona. It is licensure, PT or PTA licensure through the application process, which includes a variety of things such as documentation, exam passing, transcripts. Those items are dependent on the application type that is selected, as well as another pathway to practice is through the PT compact privilege, which there's a fair amount of misunderstanding in the practice about what a privilege is. A privilege is not a state license. It is a privilege to practice in one compact state based on a license in good standing in the home compact state. So there are certain states that by definition are excluded because they have not passed the required legislation to become compact states. There are certain states that have passed legislation and are in the process of moving towards issuing compact privileges. So a compact state is considered when that state has not only passed the legislation, but is also actively issuing and accepting other compact privileges. And there's a variety of considerations that go with that. With a compact privilege, everything revolves around the home state license, the home state license expiration date, the home state of residence in that state where the license is held. All of those play a part in that process. The third option is an interstate telehealth provider registration, and that is allowed by statute. Mm-hmm. It is not specific to the physical therapy board. It is something that is across the healthcare boards. In essence, the individual is not licensed in Arizona, is not in Arizona practicing, but wishes to practice telehealth into Arizona from the state in which they are licensed. So that's a registration process. They are responsible for providing some information, including a statutory agent in this state, including a proof of insurance, a variety of those kind of requirements. They do have to provide the board with verifications of their existing licenses, and that's all licenses regardless of status. But they do not take the jurisprudence exam. They do not have to provide any NPTE exam scores. Et cetera. It's a registration. They are responsible for renewing that registration. It's by the statute, it's more termed of an update. So they have to update that information basically annually. There is one fee, and that is with the initial registration, and that is by statute. So those are the three pathways to practice. The information that I tried to present to you was just kind of a basic outline of how it occurs, as well as any kind of specifics or where information is found about those various options for the public, for anyone seeking those. I'm sure as of the last meeting, based on this, especially with compact privileges with telehealth, and how that may or may not relate to a license or the process of going from one to the other. So I want to address any questions that you may have rather than just reading through the information that was provided to you.
The main question I have is, because we've had a few cases that have come up recently with someone who has a compact privilege changing their address to Arizona as their home state and then moving toward licensure. But once they change their address, they're no longer under that compact privilege anymore. So what would be the most effective method for them to get licensed in Arizona without interrupting their practice? Or is there even a method for that?
Mm-hmm. There absolutely is. So first and foremost, the most important thing is that the individual seeking these processes reviews the requirements for these processes. That's imperative. The PT Compact website has an abundance of information in it. So with a PT Compact, the practitioner practices in the compact state based on their home state license. Should they have a change in residence, one of the newest rules that was changed by the PT Compact, rather than 30 business days to inform the compact of that change of home state residence, they have 60 business days to do that now. If they're seeking a license, they can absolutely concurrently apply for a license in Arizona. Typically, that's done through a license by endorsement. It depends on which license type that individual qualifies for based on their own circumstances. One of the inherent problems that we do see, and we try to guard against this, we've tried to provide information, is that there is an inherent conflict between application by universal recognition to an active PT compact, because the PT compact, part of it is that you cannot work in your home state of residence on a compact. You're required to get a license, and then that license can affect other compact privileges as well. Universal recognition was an initiative put forth into statute that is specific to Arizona residents to help them get through the licensing process, to make those maneuvers to get through the licensing process. We have, by rule, up to 75 days, and that doesn't include time for satisfying deficiencies. So the clock stops ticking when that application has any deficiencies in it, and that includes exam scores. So the 60 days to change your residence officially through the compact is less than the 75 that it can take an application to process. Now, staff always tries to process these applications as swiftly as possible. There is no benefit to us to hold on to these applications or to slow them down in any way. But that can come in a variety of ways. It can come when they have to appear before the board. There's a background question. They're requesting accommodations for exam, any variety of things. So we try to identify that universal recognition is not an appropriate application type with an active compact privilege. Mm-hmm. However, we've had many, many, many go through this process and apply by endorsement and they work on their compact privilege right up until the point where they get an Arizona license. Now, they typically then will establish residency after they've gotten their Arizona license. But those people that do it before, if they're still within the 60-day window, they're within the 60-day window. We recognize that and just process them normally because they're still in their time frame that they've been allowed to do it. The individuals that have come before you typically have established residency long before they've applied, and or they couple that with also applying by universal recognition, which, again, it doesn't function that way because we have to make sure of the residency status in the universal, and we have to make sure that they're operating under a compact privilege as a non-resident of the state if they're outside of that window. So that's where those struggles come in. That's where you've seen that. And in fact, some of those cases have renewed that compact privilege using a prior driver's license than the newest one that they've gotten. And we don't discover that until we're looking through their application after all the documentation has been provided, that we see their image of their driver's license. Some of them are an Arizona driver's license, and we can do the math to see when it was issued and how it applies to their application selection, as well as they're working under a compact privilege or under a license. So yes, there is absolutely a way to do it. There are conflicting structures to be careful when they're doing that. And we see a great deal of prevalence with compact privileges of gathering a variety of them, working with recruiters. So, you know, just like if someone is going to go get a license in another state, it is incumbent upon them to understand the process as well as to understand the laws and rules that they're going to be working under. And it's no different with a compact privilege. However, that is sometimes overlooked in the process.
Well, basically, it's if they have a compact privilege, mm-hmm. they have 60 days through the compact to report that. That, you know, it doesn't align perfectly with how many days they have, or how many days it takes for the endorsement to process in Arizona. But ideally, they should be able with no issues that come up, or, you know, needing to appear before the board or anything like that. You know, mm-hmm. there's the hope is that we can get that license issued within that 60-day period so that they can practice on that license at that point.
And if they haven't established residency in this state by switching their driver's license, then they're not held to that 60 days. The real crux of the issue is if they go get their driver's license or they establish their residency in terms of that driver's license. The driver's license, and it said 5 or 6 times on the how to get privileges page of the PT compact, the driver's license can very distinctly, it does very distinctly impact their quote unquote home state of residence according to the definition of the PT compact. So it specifically says in there that if they establish residency by getting another driver's license somewhere else, that can and will affect their compact privileges, and it might affect multiple compact privileges. So for example, a person who is licensed in Texas has a compact privilege in Arizona. They get their Arizona driver's license. They go through the 60-day process. Let's say they also have an Ohio compact privilege, a Washington compact privilege, 3 or 4 others. When they change that that home state address, that home reflective of their new driver's license, when they change that through their portal, if they're not licensed yet in Arizona, all of those compact privileges are terminated because they're no longer licensed in their home state. So it the home state, the declaration of home state, the establishment of residency in that new home state is really pivotal in terms of compact privileges. So the advice is, if you're intending to seek a license in that state and planning to eventually move there, start that application process. Let's get that rolling, get it through either while you're sort of making those moves or before you make those residency moves, because then you have a license in your quote unquote next home state, and you can get your driver's license, and then it insulates the rest of your privileges. The compact privilege, it cannot be overstated, but the compact privilege revolves around that home state, that designation of home state. And if the rules are not adhered to, it can have disastrous effects.
Judy, just to confirm, there is no residency requirement for being licensed in Arizona, right?
No, there's not, with the exception of application by universal recognition.
Got it. So really the issue that we have is people are finding this application by universal recognition, which is not meant for this kind of a thing, and they are utilizing it improperly, which is causing them to have their PTU, their compact privileges revoked.
That is one pathway of issue that you've encountered. The other pathway of issue is establishing residency here, sometimes months in advance of seeking an actual license.
Got it.
However they apply at that point, if the documentation received by the board clearly states that they've been practicing on a compact privilege, having exceeded that 60 days on an Arizona driver's license, that too is a problem.
Got it. Okay. That makes sense. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm reading on here then is that they, and what I'm hearing from you, Judy, is they don't have to have an Arizona driver's license to apply for a Arizona PT or PTA license. They just need a government issued ID. So passport or something like that would be fine.
Any state license will work for that. Yes, there is no requirement to be an Arizona resident to apply in Arizona for a PT or PTA license, with the exception of the universal recognition application.
Got it. Okay.
Okay. So yes, so somebody who's working on a compact privilege, if they're even thinking of moving, and it's, you know, sort of morphing into a reality or a potential reality, the next step is really to start working towards a license in that state. And that's not just Arizona. These rules are not specific to Arizona. These are the compact rules of how they, you know, how, and they sign up for them, right? So they identify, they indicate their driver's license in their compact privilege purchase process. They, attest to, you know, meeting the requirements of it. Unfortunately, they just may not really be informed about what it is that they're doing. They're just kind of collecting their privileges.
Got it. Thank you.
We're seeing this more and more. There's a big push for travel. There's, you know, like never before, we're seeing brand new applicants who have just recently graduated, who have a multitude of licenses and compact privileges, and a lot of times they are working with companies that have a recruiter or, you know, somebody that's just assisting them through all of these processes. But, you know, one of the benefits of a compact privilege is that they're not required to comply with the continuing education requirements of the state for the compact privilege. All of that revolves around their home state license. But if they were getting various licenses, they would be expected to comply with everything, including continuing education. And in the compact privilege, that's one thing that is much nicer for that traveler, for those individuals who are moving around a lot. But there's still no shortcut to understanding what your doing with your license?
Judy, I just want to say I'm so grateful that you put all of this in a document for us. It can be confusing. We don't see things on your side, like applications and things like that. And so when things come before us, sometimes I've been confused on what type of license you're applying for. So this is just an incredible resource. And perhaps maybe we can put it on the board website at some point just to help people understand the difference. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's already there and I just haven't seen it. But thank you for this. I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
Along those lines, I'm wondering if it's within our abilities to have this recording posted as well on the website of this discussion, and if there's any part that we, you know, in terms of I'm looking at the State Board Physical Therapy website under 2024 PT Compact, no more. I mean,
if I'm applying to Compact, this conversation I think would be useful for them to listen to all of the nuances. So I'm wondering if this part, this recorded part, can be sectioned out and put into the website under no more.
Or added to the frequently asked questions or something.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah.
There, you know, there's always room for improvement on the website. There's always room for tackling some of these issues. Some of the things that we have to be really careful of, though, is with respect to the application, all of this information and more is on the website with each application type. It's reiterated again when they actually go in to apply. They have to select their application type. Each one of those types, before they even move into the application, identifies, you know, use this if this is your circumstance. Use this if this is your, do not use this one if this is your circumstance. Those are all before they even select. So their responsibility in those circumstances is to read it. Aside from that, the PT Compact, while the board offers PT Compact privileges in this state, the information for that is housed on the PT Compact website, because if they suddenly change something, we refrain from putting all information on our website about the PT Compact, because if something changes, you know, we're not going to know that all of a sudden, and we run the risk of our documentation, our information being obsolete. So what we have opted to do up until this point is to put the basic information there that hits those high point caveats. Be careful when you get your established residency. Do not use this type of application. Those things are on our website, but then we have a robust set of links that sends them to the PT Compact website for their information. And, you know, the snippets of information, and there's entirely possible we could, you know, come up with a form and we could do some highlights and things like that. But what we have to be really careful is that those types of documents, and I think Mr. Harris will back me up on this one, those type of documents do not substitute for the breadth of information that they're responsible for by statute.
Yeah.
So that's where it gets a little touchy. That's not to say we can't do it. It's just, it has to be managed in a very careful manner.
Yeah. Good point.
And if I could just build upon what Judy just said, you know, the board does a really good job of communicating and providing information. And Judy, please jump in and correct me. But, you know, for the most part, people get it right. And you only see those one-offs. And there's a lot of people that apply. It's a growing profession. And the vast majority of them do it the right way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we feel
I think that is part of the issue is that mm-hmm. we only see the people who screw it up, right? Everybody mm-hmm. else is a statistic. But I do appreciate it. And frankly, I mean, I think there is some value to saying if you're going to practice in a field like this where, you know, accuracy and consistency is key, your ability to follow instructions, I think, is a big part of getting licensed. So
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
There is that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we get these calls, these emails day in and day out, and we explain as much as humanly possible. And most of them then, you know, heed that. Most of them then work, but Mr. Harris is exactly right. You see the cases that don't.
Right. And I, just as an educator, I'm seeing a whole lot less reading. So, I can ask someone to read something, but that doesn't mean that they would actually read it. And I know I absolutely agree. You've done a lot of things to make it easy for them. And maybe we are seeing the small percentage of individuals that are not following through, but asking someone to read something anymore, it's just declining in society. It's really tough.
And that presents its own problem because
it does.
These are intricate processes and they're demanding processes and they, you know, that it's somebody's livelihood.
It is.
And something that they've worked really hard to gain in terms of the education and the examinations that go along with it. So,
right.
There's no substitute for that. There's no way to, you know, you get a new piece of electronic and you got the quick start guide. Well, that's great, but that doesn't tell you everything that you need to know. And, you know, I mean, that's just operating a piece of electronics, but this really is their livelihood. And that's the piece of it that there's a lot of laws and rules that go into all of it.
Right.
So.
I do appreciate your presentation, Judy, and this discussion was really helpful to understand it better.
Perfect. Happy to answer any questions. We deal with this daily.
I have one more question regarding the telehealth registration. So you mentioned that somebody applying for that doesn't have to take the jurisprudence exam. Is that correct? But then correct. One of the bullet points on here says must follow Arizona standards of care for the physical therapy profession. How are they being educated on what our standards are if they don't have to take the jurisprudence exam?
The jurisprudence exam is not something that is allowed in the statute that established the interstate telehealth process. It was one of the questions that was addressed very early on in that after those laws passed to determine whether that was allowable or not. And it was identified that no, this is purely telehealth. That said, those individuals practicing in this way are under the regulation of this board. So if a complaint came in, they would come before you just like any other licensee or compact privilege holder, and you would have the regulatory authority to address those issues, to address whatever allegations they're facing.
Would we be able to hold them to those regulations if they've never been in a situation where they had to be tested on them? Or is it just expected that, hey, you're doing telehealth, make sure you go through our statutes on the website so that you have a good understanding of them?
Well, they have to, there's part of it that attests that, yes, I am subject to, I'm paraphrasing, I don't know the exact terminology, I don't remember it. But they're basically attesting to the fact that they will practice within the laws and rules of this state. They're held accountable for those things. They are required to do them. If somebody came before you and the board found violations of our statutes and rules, the board would most certainly be able to adjudicate that matter and issue discipline. That hasn't happened yet. How we would report that information, I'm not sure, but we would figure that out once we get to that, once we cross that bridge. But yeah, these the practitioners under telehealth are purely doing telehealth. And it is in response to a statute 36-3606 that is not specific to physical therapy. This is a practice that every board in Arizona is adhering to. Okay. Any other questions? Any additional information that you'd like?
Thank you so much, Judy. We appreciate this.
Not a problem. Should further questions come along, let us know. And Phoenix has returned to the meeting. She returned at 11:20, so just to put that into the record as well. Are you ready to move on to the next item?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So in the same vein of bringing information to the board, we received from the Center for Personalized Education for Professionals an unsolicited slide deck that was really quite interesting. So they were in town representing at a conference and decided to provide this information. So this is the company that provides the PROBE Ethics and Boundaries courses. Mm-hmm. And we found it was really interesting when we received that to just kind of look through it. And we thought it would be a really good idea to provide it to the board in a sense, because, you know, you do see cases where you do require the PROBE or the PBI, and what was once maybe one course has begun to expand a little bit, in so much as they offer sometimes a kind of a follow-up situation that occurs for multiple weeks, in addition to just the regular course. So it's something that we thought would be really interesting for the board. So while their courses have grown, they've also gotten some additional options. So for example, they have additional courses. They have the course extensions. Each one of them has sort of their own course extension. It's not on all courses, but on the vast majority of them it is an option. It's an option. Passing criteria. So should you identify that you want somebody to take the PROBE or the PBI, there is certain passing criteria that can be utilized, and certain courses might be more appropriate for certain cases that you review. So for example, with sexual misconduct cases, all of the boundaries courses are, you know, kind of open to that kind of element. But then there are also others that are more documentation based or practice based without that element of misconduct, sexual misconduct. So, you know, some of the other courses are interesting. So when you require the PROBE or the PBI, then staff kind of takes a look at the information to help determine which is the most appropriate based on the findings of facts and conclusions of law to be the most appropriate. PBI Education recently sent out an email indicating that they have zero interest payment plans associated with them, because these are expensive courses. Mm-hmm. There's a medical chaperoning course that's available. So we saw this when this came through, we saw this as a resource, and we just wanted to bring it to you just to identify what is available, what can this look like in an order. This can look like whatever you want it to look like in an order, but at the same point, in addition to the course, you can identify whether you want a certain passing rate or whether you want them to participate in an extended you know, the extension options that are available as follow-up. So the net sum result of this is we just wanted to bring it to your attention so you know what's available.
Great, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any questions?
Is there a difference between these two websites in terms of the content? Is it like, would it just be based on our, which one we like more, or because the presentation doesn't really specify anything with that?
No, there's two different providers in this space. There's potentially more, but there's two different providers that seem to be the ones that the board refers to more often or utilizes more often, is more specific in this profession or applicable to this profession, I guess. And those providers are CPEP and PBI. CPEP offers the Probe Ethics and Boundaries Program, which has with it, they have an extended edition. They offer three levels of passing, either fail or pass or unconditional pass. They recommend an unconditional pass when it comes to a board order. They've each got their set of instructors. So if you think of it in terms of continuing education, there's different providers. So their websites are pretty robust in the information that they provide about the different courses, but it's two different providers. There's with Probe, you've got Ethics and Boundaries. With PBI, there's one specific track that is Professional Boundaries. It is you know, concentrated on that area. So Probe may be a little bit more a little broader approach, whereas PBI tends to be a little more specific in their approach. But you know, there have been a number of individuals who have gone through these courses. When you hear about the courses, it's not uncommon to hear them come back and say, that was a really enlightening course. That was a really, you know, it made me think. And they're designed that way. These are intensive courses. These are like 24-hour courses. And then if you add that extended option, that's like a hour a week or something. I can't remember the exact time frame, but it's like an hour a week for 12 weeks or something like that, where they just get a little more one-on-one or small group or whatever the case. So, you know, the board doesn't order these in every case, but there are certain cases that the board has seen fit to order these options. So, you know, there are some of them where perhaps you might consider adding an extension to it if the case itself warrants it, or but yeah, that's, and it helps to have the ability to kind of, you know, maybe not specify the one course, because there are options that allow the companies to, if there's concerns about which course do we select, there are those kind of processes that we can engage in. But typically, you know, that's the investigator, Mr. Harris, you know, any of those questions are kind of bounced around. And if there were any kind of concern about what was ordered, we would certainly bring it back to the board for clarification if there was any kind of questions about that.
And just a quick question, the professional boundaries course looks like it has supervisory issues. Is that, that was one of the things that you had talked to me specifically about. I'm wondering if they would go into details of supervision specific to Arizona, if it would just be a general
The overwhelming availability out there in the marketplace today is supervision. And if it's specific to physical therapy, they tend to go with, you know, the supervision of PTA by PTs, based on APTA. But again, that's national. There is, very little out there at all that is specific to Arizona's supervision laws and, you know, other than our statutes, rules, and policy statements.
So would you like us to make a motion to require an unconditional pass for successful completion?
I think that's probably something that we would handle on a case by case, maybe Mr. Harris, because unconditional pass, that's specific to probe.
I would agree. Yes.
You know, I mean, a motion could say, you know, passing at the highest available level or highest achievable level or something like that. And that would be my thought. Also, if you're making that kind of motion, one of the questions, and we'll try to prompt you with those kind of reminders, you know, another question would be, okay, so you're assigning this course. Would you also like to assign it to be the extended version or the basic version? You know, we can do our best to lead you down those paths when those things are requested. Anything else?
Can we put this document and the pathways document that we just finished discussing in the administrative meeting document folder in case we ever want to go back and look at them?
Sure.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'll put those there after this meeting. Okay. Any other questions there? Shall we move on? Mm-hmm. Okay. So the next thing is specific to potential supervision terms while on probation, while an individual's on probation. This kind of came a little more to light now that students are no longer in the supervision ratio. The question before the board is we're asking whether adding a student supervision restriction provision to all disciplinary actions that include at least monitoring or supervision requirements, whether that would be something that you would like us to do. So it would then become part of our standard terminology in the one, we're developing the board orders and the consent agreements to restrict supervision of student PTs and PTAs throughout the period of monitoring or throughout the probationary period if monitoring is engaged, monitoring or supervision of that respondent is required.
So Judy, just for my clarification, so it's not for everyone who's on probation with CEUs and retake the jurisprudence. It's only for people who are on probation and part of their board order or consent agreement includes that they are being monitored or supervised or mentored.
Yeah, that's the way it was brought to you. The board, if you wanted it a part of everything, I anticipate that we could potentially do that. Whether it's needed or not, I don't know. That would be up to you. But it becomes a question because we have run into it in the past where a person who is undergoing monitoring themselves is being a clinical instructor for a student.
Yeah.
I wonder, you know, when we look at the definitions, that talks about engaging in administration, consultation, education, and research. If someone is on probation, I don't really want them doing any of those things. All I want them to do is focus on patient care. So I know this is specific about supervision, but I really don't want them doing administration, consultation, or research either. So that, potentially, I imagine case by case that we could make that point that we don't want them doing anything else except for patient care. Is that?
Yeah, I think, Madam Chair, members of the board, I think, John, that's right. That would be, you know, something that you would discuss in real time if it made sense in that particular case. Mm-hmm. But we've got to be careful because, as you just pointed out, the agenda item is fairly limited.
It is.
So we can certainly address that either at a future meeting or just in real time when a case presents that type of discussion.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great question. And I'm a little bit torn on like probation period versus being monitored, but I mean, I'll go with whatever the board decides.
Well, and members of the board, the only thing about making it generic and all, you know, some cases just don't have anything to do with supervision or monitoring, you know. And so I'm not sure that it makes sense to put it in as a boilerplate recital provision, but it certainly was worth bringing to you in those cases where part of the terms of probation is placing the professional on some sort of monitoring, you know, restriction.
Totally understand what you're saying, Mr. Harris. My thought is, though, being the person who places a ton of students in a hospital with CIs, if they're on probation, there's been disciplinary action around their practice. And I'm not sure if we don't notify the schools. They're not obligated to notify the schools. And so my thought is that if they're currently in a disciplinary process based on their own license, I just wonder how appropriate it is that they would supervise, and now they can supervise as many students as they want, supervise students in that setting, given that they themselves have been found to be not practicing according to, you know, mm-hmm. quality practice, I guess, or whatever. But so that's just where my thought is sure. Just generally speaking.
Yeah, the role model, they wouldn't be setting a good role model. And I'm thinking specifically related to 2368 from today's agenda in terms of administration part, right? I know it's about supervising, but I think part of the conversation that we had in I better stop. Because I go back to what you said, Mr. Harris, about it being individual. So.
Yeah. And the way it's agendized today, it is so specific. If you'd prefer to have a much larger discussion, we can certainly bring it back at a future meeting. And of course, that doesn't prevent you in the interim when issuing any orders or consent agreements from specifically putting whatever provisions you think are appropriate based upon the facts in the interim.
I'd like it added then, if that's possible, for a later agenda.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And I'm in agreement with you, Dr. King. Like, if we have somebody in a monitoring or supervision situation, like, I wouldn't want them to have a student either, just because of the role model aspect of it. Mm-hmm. One of my concerns, if we make that just an overall rule, is if we have somebody come to the board and get disciplined and they already have a student, what are we going to do in those situations? It ends up being a punishment to the student if all of a sudden we say, now you can't supervise the student anymore. And if there's nobody else within that organization for them to go to, they basically lose that clinical experience and have to redo it with somebody else. So I'm hesitant to put it as like a, yes, this is going to happen for everybody, as opposed to a one-off situation, you know, case by case.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good point, Giovanni. I think, mm-hmm. I think though, they could have a student and still have that more egregious problem, that we don't, you know, that will require monitoring and will require, more supervision. A lot of times that doesn't happen until weeks later. And so likely if there was a student in process, they'd already be done before any of that would start. But somebody in process that, like, you know, today we're going to make a ruling and within 30 days it'll be, handled. It could impact them.
Yeah.
So today, Dr. Bustier, are you wanting the board to make a motion around approving or not approving this as it stated in the agenda?
I think we're.
Yeah, I think, Madam Chair, members of the board, at this point, based upon the conversation, maybe it's just to continue the discussion and broaden it at a future board meeting. If everybody's okay with that, unless you wanted to make a specific, a motion on the specific scenario. Mm-hmm.
Do we need to do that right now?
No.
Okay.
I was going to say, do we have any outstanding consent agreements or whatnot that this needs to be considered for?
No.
Okay.
No, this is just something that we kind of, you know, discussed as we were, you know, memorializing prior board, you know, motions, and thought we would bring it before you for discussion.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'll move that we bring this discussion back and broaden the scope, to include, all the areas that Dr. Hike, discussed, administration, practice, research. And there was one more.
Consultation.
Do we need to be specific, Mr. Harris, on broadening, or do we just say to broaden the discussion to discuss?
I think we'll work on that, but I think we can, you know, put language to include.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Do we need a second?
Oh, second. And that was research, administration, education, and what else, John? What was the
first? Consultation. That was helpful. Thank you.
Any further discussion?
Okay, I think I got it. Okay, and I apologize. Dr. Bustillo, you moved. Who seconded that one?
I did, Kelly.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
So it's been moved and seconded to table the discussion of supervision terms while on probation, and to broaden the scope at a future meeting to include consideration of supervision restrictions of probationary measures and research, administration, education, and consultation. Okay, Dr. Bustillo?
Yes.
Dr. King?
Yes.
Mr. Leone?
Yes.
Mr. Greer?
Yes.
Mr. Barton?
Yes.
Dr. Hike?
Yes.
That motion passes. Okay, on to the fun stuff, the financials. Any questions on the financials?
So on the line item for non-capital, I'm just kidding. I don't really know anything.
I was so impressed, Giovanni.
Like, oh, I'm ready to discuss it. Come on.
The new Mr. Clinton.
There we go. There we go.
Oh, Michael. Oh, gosh.
Sadly, I think Mr. Clinton and I could have nerded out on some of that stuff.
Totally.
So next up are the licenses and registrations issued in September of 2024. As you will see, we are no longer issuing certificates. So they are all licenses now.
Yay.
Awesome.
Yes.
Okay. Any questions about those numbers, those that breakdown, anything at all? All right. Any future agenda items?
No, but I want to wish everyone who's going to the annual meeting for the FSCPT safe travels.
Yes.
Bring well, us we back. Have to discuss that after we adjourn this meeting.
Okay. So I always get that wrong.
Next up is adjournment.
And it's in Iowa, right?
Yeah. I move that we adjourn the meeting so I can talk about other things.
Second.
All right. It's been moved and seconded to adjourn. Dr. Bustillo.
Yes.
Dr. King.
Yes.
Mr. Leone.
Yes.
Mr. Greer.
Yes.
Mr. Barton.
Yes.
Dr. Hike.
Yes.
That motion passes. The meeting is adjourned at 11:48 and the recording will stop at that same time.